Welcome to Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik. Thank you for tuning in. It is Friday. Again, if you can believe it, the weeks are just flying by. I hope you had a good week nonetheless. And of course, as always, it's great to have you with us. So thank you for being here. On this radio program, we discuss a lot of different topics. We've highlighted many concerns and angles to the unfolding problems, and we appreciate hearing new perspectives and give voices to those who are not featured in the mainstream media. Usually, but not always, we're talking about some of the most shunned and suppressed people who do a lot of good work and research, who has broken free from the social conditioning and mind control, and who has consequently begun to question the imposed sacred values of our time that, despite their good intentions, is taking us closer and closer to a global collapse. The agenda of the global elite and their intentions is what we question primarily on this program, but we feature a lot of other topics as well. You can find more at redeyesecretions.com, radio, news, and videos, and also, of course, check out our archives at redeyesmembers.com, almost 900 shows on all kinds of different topics. Today we have John Rappaport back on the program for an extended segment on the latest vaccine autism link cover-up, or a vaccine gate might be the right word. We are also going to talk about the Ebola story a little bit later. John Rappaport is an investigative journalist, author, and publisher of the website NoMoreFakeNews.com. He's worked as an investigative reporter for 30 years, writing articles on politics, medicine, and health. And although his main focus over these years have been the power of the imagination and creativity, he's most often cited and interviewed on conspiracies and global elites. Well, we have a lot to discuss on Ebola later in the program as well, so stay tuned for that. But we'll begin on the whistleblower, the insider from CDC that spoke out about the vaccine autism link, a massive crime of the pharmaceutical governmental network. Stay tuned. John Rappaport, welcome back to the radio program. Great to have you here again. Hope you're doing well. It was great meeting you, of course, in San Mateo, California, just a few months ago, really, here. But it's a pleasure having you back on the show. How are you today?
I'm fine. San Mateo was great. Thanks so much for that, and it's always great to be back on the radio with you.
Thank you, John. Really appreciate that. Now, we're going to kind of, cut right to the major story here that we're going to talk about today. It's a huge breaking news, of course, that you covered on NoMoreFakeNews.com a few days ago, really, in terms of what has been going on with the CDC. Very explosive story. Unfortunately, we haven't heard that much of it in the mainstream, if anything, really. But let's break this down first. There's a lot of components to it. Let's talk about the people involved, what occurred. It's one of those kind of phone calls, once again, that we've talked about that in the past, of how these phone calls are recorded in some way and they're leaked in some way as well. We'll see what you know about the details of that. But, yeah, break it down for us, and let's just dive right into it, John.
Okay. The phone calls are very important. Sometime around November 2013, an engineer named Brian Hooker, who was doing research on vaccines and their connection to autism, because I understand he has a child with autism, was contacted out of the blue by a research scientist at the CDC. And they had ensuing discussions on the telephone. Now, some of these conversations have been posted on YouTube through the Autism Media Channel. And what's reflected in those fragmentary phone conversations over the course of roughly 9 or 10 months is a very remorseful man at the CDC, whose identity we don't know, who is saying that he was party to a fraud, a scientific fraud at the CDC, that specifically involved a study that was published in 2004, 10 years or so earlier, and published in a very prestigious journal called Pediatrics. And this study was a study of children in the Atlanta, Georgia area, attempting to see if there was a connection between the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, and the ensuing development of autism in these children. And the whistleblower is more or less saying, and we presume that most of the time on these phone calls he's talking to Brian Hooker, but sometimes maybe he's talking to Dr. Andrew Wakefield. We get the distinct impression, again, that he is extremely remorseful, that he omitted vital data in that study of a subset of African-American children, which showed a massively increased risk of autism in conjunction with the receiving the MMR vaccine. And having omitted that data, the conclusion of the study was cooked, slanted, to reflect that there was no connection between the vaccine and autism. This unknown CDC whistleblower seems quite aware that, therefore, he aided and abetted destruction, death, brain damage for 10 years by keeping all this a secret in many children, not just African-American children, all over the U.S. and presumably all over the world who were receiving this vaccine. Kept it a secret.
Yep.
We still don't know who he is in August of 2014, but toward the end of August, my sources are telling me that it looks like he's coming out of the closet. Then, no, he's not. Yes, he is. No, he's not. He's hesitating. And possibly he tells Andrew Wakefield or Brian Hooker, do what you think is best in regard to his identity. So the picture that emerges of this CDC whistleblower, a research scientist at the CDC, an insider, a co-author of a study, is of a very conflicted man. Doesn't want to endanger himself. I mean, his life could be in danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Family could be in danger. He could be killed. His reputation could be destroyed. All kinds of things could happen to him. Not the least of which is he loses his job and his career and so forth and so on. So finally, somewhere around August 24th, 25th of this year, somebody, and I presume it's Andrew Wakefield, decides that, you know, he's had enough. He's going to reveal this guy's identity because he knows who he is. And so does Brian Hooker. And people have to understand that Dr. Andrew Wakefield has a stake in this game because his whole reputation was destroyed as a doctor in England because he even dared to suggest a possible connection between the MMR vaccine and autism.
They've been fiercely attacked, along with many other people that have been pointing for how long to connection here, you know? So he has a, it's a personal vendetta at this stage to show that he was right, you know?
Yeah, this, I think, with Wakefield goes back to 1998.
Well,
he's now living in Texas. His medical license has been stripped to practice in England. You know, reputation destroyed in the press, career taken away from him. And so on and so forth. So now on YouTube, as of about August 25th, 24th, we understand that this secret CDC whistleblower is Dr. William Thompson. Okay, cat is out of the bag. A few days later, on August 27th, we learned that Thompson has a lawyer, Rick Morgan, Cincinnati, Ohio. Thompson lives in the Atlanta area. And Morgan is a whistleblower specialist, very well known. And through the lawyer, Thompson releases a published statement. Now, people have to understand this never happens. I mean, ever. there have been accusations, correct accusations of fraud leveled at authors of medical and scientific studies before, of course, but in my memory, never has one of the actual authors, a reputable scientist, come out of the shadows and said, essentially, I and my co-authors committed fraud by omitting a vital set of data in a published study. So that's what he says in his published statement. Omitted vital data, broke the protocol of the study. These are all code words for we lied, we committed fraud, we did this 10 years ago. We covered up an association between the MMR vaccine and autism in children. Not just African-American children, but children. So this is a titanic story. This should have been a page one story, certainly in the U.S. press and on television, leading the nightly news.
Yeah.
But nothing. A media blackout. Total media blackout, which has continued with very few exceptions until this day. And we're talking here on September 25th, so it's a month later. Nothing, really. Absolutely nothing, which means the story is being controlled. The story is being sat on. This is one of these stories where the press, mainstream press, is not just behaving because it instinctively knows what it can cover or and can't cover. You know, the word is coming down from higher up to news outlets and their parent companies. Keep this story away from the public. That's the only way that a blackout of this proportions could be maintained. And I can understand why, as a reporter who's been working for 30 years, because were this story to come out in full bloom and all of the revelations behind it, including what Thompson said anonymously on these fragmentary phone calls that were recorded, he says without his permission or knowledge, because he goes a lot further in these recorded phone calls than he did in his published statement. This could bring down the entire vaccine establishment, including the CDC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, their reputation, everything they've been doing, all of that is hanging on this thread, you know? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the co-authors of this 2004 study, the one that we're referring to that was published in Pediatrics, Frank DiStefano, Colleen Boyle, these are now major figures at the CDC. They're not just authors of a study. They are both high-ranking executives in the vaccine division involved with safety of vaccines. These co-authors, including Thompson, have published other work on vaccines, not just this vaccine. So if the story broke in a big way, you would see the CDC and other outside investigators forced to go back and go over many studies on vaccines and autism, including mercury and vaccines and so forth, where the U.S. government has said over and over and over again that they proved there's absolutely no connection between mercury and vaccines and autism. All of this would now be back on the table. And a reinvestigation of dozens, maybe more, studies published out of the CDC would be under grave suspicion.
Yeah, to say the least.
To say the least,
yeah.
Exactly, if not automatically refuted. So the journal in which this 2004 study was published, Pediatrics, has come out now. A spokesperson for the journal has talked to investigative reporter Cheryl Atkinson, who used to work for CBS News, and told her that the journal officially refuses to retract that 2004 study, which is staggering, because one of the authors comes out and says, we omitted vital data, we broke the protocol on the study, essentially saying we committed fraud. and the journal refuses to retract the study. Refuses, from everything we can gather, to even speak with Thompson and get his view on why he knows that the study was a fraud. They just, you know, robotically stand by the study and forget all about it. So, in one of these fragmentary phone calls that was recorded and can be seen at the Autism Media Channel, Thompson refers specifically to thimerosal, which is mercury, in vaccines. And he says that he would never give a pregnant woman a vaccine containing mercury. Despite the fact that in the United States, forget about other countries where there is still mercury in many vaccines, the flu vaccine still contains mercury, some flu vaccines, and these are given to pregnant women. He says, I would never do that. That would be, you know, insane. And furthermore, Thompson says, again, using science speak, there is biological plausibility for asserting right now that mercury in vaccines causes autism-like features, meaning autism. So he goes a lot further when he's off the record in these phone calls, which even adds to the enormity of what he's exposing. Now, what's confusing here a bit is the timeline of events, because from everything that I can gather, and I've been looking at this probably more than any other reporter since the story broke, is that Thompson, heavily conflicted, going back and forth, I'm going to out myself, I'm not going to out myself, I'm going to say who I am, I'm not, I'm going to leave it up to Wakefield and Brian Hooker to decide. He has to tell the CDC that he feels he's about to be outed, his name is going to be released, or as soon as his name is released and he is outed on or about August 24th, he goes to his bosses and he says, well, the cat's out of the bag. And he goes to his bosses because he doesn't want to spring this as a complete surprise on them, because the repercussions on him personally would be that much more nasty if the CDC were caught unawares. So my inference is that Thompson, the whistleblower, went to the CDC before he was outed and said, look, I've made mistakes. I've been remorseful. I'm not in a good place emotionally here. I've done things, you know, that I don't know whether I should have done them, but it's too late now. There's a problem here. I've talked to people on the phone. They've recorded me. They're releasing these phone calls. We have to sit down and make a deal. I'm going to release a statement through my attorney. I've lawyered up, and I'm going to make an admission about the 2004 study. And I want to tell you so that you can get out in front of this and we can make a deal. I keep my job. I don't at any time in the future suddenly lash out at the CDC. We play nice with each other. You release some kind of statement yourself about the 2004 study. I agree to work with Congress if they have a hearing. And that's about it. And we hope all this goes away. And they look at him and they say, you know, what are our options here? I mean, the cat's gone out of the bag. So what can we do here? I mean, do we kill this guy? Do we try to fire him? Do we make it all worse now? Or do we just play nice and pretend that everything is okay and then institute a massive media blackout and assume that the story is going to die of natural causes? And that's what the CDC opts for. And I just discovered this morning that, in fact, the CDC did release a statement, a press release, on August 25th, 2 days before Thompson went public through his lawyer, in which the CDC specifically refers to this 2004 pediatric study, which Thompson will 2 days later say is a fraud. And in that press release, the CDC defends the validity of the study and points to exactly what Thompson would reveal 2 days later and tries to defend it, namely that the authors of the study omitted a vital set of data that showed increased risk of autism. And the CDC tries to explain away why that set of data was omitted and utterly fails, which I explain in an article that I'm writing now. Because the CDC would want everyone to assume that the authors of the study looked at a whole wide range of children, see, and found different rates of autism in different groups of children who received the MMR vaccine. And then after they had done all of that research, suddenly they looked back and they said, you know, in this one group of children, they don't have any birth certificates. Now, we need the data on the birth certificates, such as birth weight, mother's background, who knows, education, whatever, because these are correlating factors that we would use, blah, 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 in our computer models of assessing risk, et cetera, et cetera. And we need those birth certificates, so I guess we'll have to drop all those kids without birth certificates away from the study and forget about them. Suddenly, after doing all this research on all these kids, these, you know, highly respected researchers go, oops, wow, we made a tremendous mistake because here's a whole group of kids who have no birth certificates and we really need the birth certificates. So I guess, gee whiz, we'll have to drop them from the study. And magically, it turns out that these very kids without birth certificates that they dropped from the study happen to be the ones with greatly increased risk of autism after receiving the MMR vaccine.
Yeah, not surprised. Not surprised,
right? Yeah. So that's some of the background on the scandal. You know, that's sort of the opening salvo. There's a lot more, but that's the beginning of it.
Oh boy! Well, a lot of components to this here. Of course, the importance here of the reputation and the overall agenda, really, of the CDC. We can get into that a little bit more later. But a couple of points here on what you mentioned so far, which I didn't. It wasn't clear yet, I guess. William Thompson, did he know that he was recorded? First of all.
Okay, that's a very good question. He claims in his written statement, released through his attorney, Rick Morgan, on August 27th, that he did not know and did not give permission to have these phone calls recorded. I don't believe that, but that's what he says. I think he knew. And because he was conflicted, you see, he wasn't of one mind about what to do. He was relying on Brian Hooker and Andrew Wakefield as his priests. You know, he was confessing his sins to them. And in particular to Wakefield, he was apologizing to Wakefield. And you can read and hear his statements to that effect by saying, you know, I could have helped save your reputation, Dr. Wakefield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I had been forthcoming in 2004, when you continued to be under heavy attack for implying that there could be a connection between the MMR vaccine and autism. And I am so sorry that I did not do that. And Wakefield says, I forgive you without any bitterness. This is a very emotional conversation that is going back and forth. And I believe personally that Thompson, the whistleblower, either knew or strongly suspected that his phone calls were being recorded by either Wakefield or Hooker or both.
Mm.
He had to say in his written statement that he was not aware and did not give his permission because if he says yes, I knew, and I gave my permission, then everything that he is saying in these, quote, informal phone calls becomes part of the official record, you see, where he goes a lot further in his condemnation of vaccines than he does in his written confession. So he wants to pull back, and in some way, not successfully, of course, but, you know, how do you save the boat when there's 100 leaks?
Right.
He's just trying to, you know, save himself and sort of say, you know, you can't depend on what I said on those phone calls because I never gave permission and I didn't know I was being recorded. And, you know, it's sort of the statement of a drowning man.
Mm.
But yes, I believe he knew, and I believe the CDC knew. And I believe this is what really triggered the whole dialogue between Thompson and the CDC, where they finally brokered a deal whereby Thompson was, in a sense, forced to make a public statement because he was already outed and the phone calls were on YouTube. What else was he going to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? So he had to make a public statement. The CD said, okay, we understand that, but we need to know that this public statement is not going to be inflammatory. Thompson says, or his lawyer says, don't worry, it won't be. And it wasn't. Thompson did not go all out in an attack. In fact, he says, my statement should in no way be interpreted to mean that I am against vaccines or vaccination. They're a wonderful miracle, you know. And I continue to work closely with CDC, et cetera, right?
Mm, yeah.
So I believe that Thompson knew that he was being recorded.
Yeah, interesting. Now, you found a William W. Thompson at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at Google Scholar that you posted in one of your articles, you know, on this kind of unfolding story. Is there, and this is most likely the person, is there any reason to be worried for some reason about the legitimacy of the call or the identity of the person or anything like that before we proceed to the more important questions here?
I expressed some doubts in my articles. Now, the William Thompson, who co-authored the 2004 paper, he is definitely a CDC scientist. And he definitely wrote the public statement on August 27th through his lawyer. So we know that these two are one and the same. Now, as to whether or not this is the man on the phone calls, I don't believe there's any doubt about this. I don't think there is any doubt. But, you know, when somebody anonymously is speaking on the phone and he is being nudged and prompted by the other person on the other end of the phone line and context is being provided by the other person on the phone line so that what this anonymous person is saying makes more sense to the audience, you do have to wonder. But you see, in his public statement, Thompson says, I did not know I was being recorded and I did not give my permission. Well, to me, this seals the deal.
Mm.
It was him on those phone calls. Otherwise, why is he saying that?
Right, yeah.
So I think we can pretty much wrap up that case.
Well, that's good. That's something for sure. Has anything similar like this happened before in terms of insiders speaking out like this, specifically from the CDC?
I've never encountered that. Now, there was a researcher named Anthony Morris. That's quite some time ago. We're going back. Was he at the FDA? Was he at the CDC? Or both? My memory's a little vague on that, but he did, in fact, speak out very virulently about vaccines and fraud. But nothing really like this in my memory, and I've been around doing this for about 30 years now, because, again, what people have to understand, this is a co-author of a study, a very significant study, which is used and referred to to say no connection between MMR vaccine and autism. He was there. He was a co-author. He now says the study was fraud. Wow. 10 years later. And anyone with, you know, an active brain can understand what this means in terms of sitting on the fraud for 10 years while children's brains continue to be damaged in great numbers by this vaccine. So, no, I don't know of any other case that's quite like this. You know, because of the there-ness of William Thompson, how much of an insider he was. You know, it's like we've had, say, you know, instances of reporters being outed at newspapers for making up information and publishing and so forth. But imagine if, for example, a reporter for the New York Times were to say, you know, in the second Gulf War, in the whole lead up, all the business about weapons of mass destruction, and I was writing articles indicating that there was evidence of such weapons and so forth. Well, I knew all along that there was no evidence. And here's exactly why I knew that. Here's the name of somebody at the CIA who gave me false information that I knew to be false. And here's somebody at from the White House that gave me false information. And, you know, here's an aide to Dick Cheney who told me that, you know, they had information on weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, he told me if it was fake information, but I said I'll run with it anyway. You know, and just comes out and admits all this, you know. I mean, that's what Thompson is basically saying here. Now, people who write, you know, so-called science blogs are rushing to defend the CDC and the vaccine establishment, and they're doing their own analysis, they say, of Thompson's data, blah, blah, blah. And the thing that they can't admit is, here's the guy himself, Thompson. What does he have to say? He was there. Now, Thompson, in his public statement on August 27th, says he will not talk to reporters. So all we right. don't know, you know, we can't get to him to find out what he would say in an extended interview in which we ask very specific questions, such as, who at the CDC in 2004 told you that you had to hide this vital data in the study? Give me a name.
Yeah.
What was the conversation like? How many conversations were there? When did they take place? Where did they take place?
How many knew, you know, and when did they know, yeah.
Right. And now we get to one of the, you know, most explosive elements of the story. Because there was somebody that we know at the CDC in 2004 that knew, who happened to be none other than the head of the CDC, Julie Gerberding, MD, because a letter from William Thompson to her in 2004 was leaked and published by Natural News, Mike Adams, about a month ago, in which we read Thompson saying to Gerberding, warning her, saying, this is 2004, right about the time that the fraudulent study was published. In a week, I'm going to be presenting, Thompson says, at a vaccine autism conference, troubling and sensitive data, which you should be aware of. He's giving her a heads up. And the meaning is clear. He's going to draw a connection, an association between the MMR vaccine and autism. And he's telling her to get out ahead of this, that she has to do something about this. And he also says to her, in the letter, we are losing the PR war on vaccines. Now, this is an underling speaking to a superior in very uncompromising tone. Why? Because he's scared. He's upset. He's probably very angry, and he's holding it in, and he doesn't know what to do. He's experiencing all of these emotions, and it's unclear whether or not he and his co-authors have already finished the research on the pediatrics study, but my conclusion would be, when he wrote the letter to Gerberding, he probably knows that he's already lied, or he's about to lie, or he's under pressure to lie. And he's a man on an island with nowhere to go. And so his letter is very uncharacteristic toward his, not just his supervisor, but his ultimate boss at the CDC, Gerberding. He's telling her in no uncertain terms to get off her butt and do something about this whole situation. She doesn't do anything. And she doesn't answer.
That's 10 years ago now, too, you know. A lot of kids, a lot of children have been getting this these vaccines since then.
That's right.
Yeah.
She doesn't answer his letter, and his appearance at that vaccine autism conference is canceled. He doesn't do his presentation of the sensitive and troubling data. Okay, flash forward now to 2009. Gerberding, who has been the head of the CDC since 2002, leaves the CDC. She, at some point after that, goes into the private sector as the president of Merck Vaccines.
Ah, good old swing door politics. Lovely.
The manufacturer of the MMR vaccine.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, as a reporter, I can tell you, what else do you need for an explosive page one story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
What else do you need for an investigative team to go after this story for months on end, digging into it? Because, again, the public doesn't really understand this, but when you have a tag end like what I just gave you to pull on, and you begin to relentlessly go after it, what happens is you force other people to come out of the woodwork and confess their sins because they're afraid. Because they don't know where to go, because they feel like rats caught in a trap, and because they become terrified that the protection they assumed they had is now gone. So they confess their sins. Then, as a reporter, you go to other people at the CDC and allied places like the Journal of Pediatrics, and you say, well, look at what I've got from so-and-so and so-and-so. Oh, my God. He told you that? Yeah. Yeah, he mentioned your name. Okay. You know, what is this guy going to do? He's now going to confess some of his sins that have to do with vaccines and autism. And the story is going to billow and bloom and expand. This is what you would expect if major media were still interested in this kind of thing at all, which they aren't, and particularly in this case, they're not, because it's the whole vaccine establishment. So we get none of that. But that's what we would get, you see. If I could call up people, and you could call up people and say, hello, this is John Rappaport from the New York Times. We're doing, as you probably know by now, an investigation of the connection between the MMR vaccine and autism and the fraudulent 2004 study at the CDC. I don't want to talk to you. Well, okay. Let me tell you the story that we're going to run with tomorrow. And you can comment if you want to. We'd like you to comment because your name is mentioned. What do you mean my name is mentioned? Well, it's right there in paragraph one of the story. You know?
Yeah.
The pressure. The pressure, the pressure. And so you do get a comment. And now you and I from the New York Times have three other guys working this same waterfront at Pediatrics Journal, at the CDC. We've got researchers from universities that are coming out of the woodwork who are telling us, contrary to what they've been saying in print all these years, well, we always knew that the dangers of vaccines in terms of brain damage and neurological damage were underplayed. We always knew that it was a lot worse than the public was led to believe. Oh, really? Tell us about that. So now, you know, the tsunami begins to build. This is what you would get in this alternative reality, which is the honest reality of honest journalism if it actually existed.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a big part of the story that people have to realize here.
Well, exactly. I mean, the cover-up is equally, if not even bigger to a certain extent, you know, in terms of even the media control and the way it's been kept out. Because as we know from other stories, those stories have gotten a, what should we call it, a foot in through the door, and they've been just, you know, burst into the rest of the media consequently. Just one article in the New York Times or something like that, it goes worldwide, like with the Putin story of how he, you know, the gay law and all that. It's a perfect example of just one story tracking back to just one origin in New York Times, and then the rest of the media picks up on cue, you know, and the a couple of hours after that point, boom, it's everywhere, you know. But that has not happened in this case. What's the strategy around that? I mean, because to a certain degree, a good strategy would be here to try to attempt to track down William Thompson. I know you said he doesn't want to talk to the media, but I mean, we've certainly seen the mainstream media parking their, you know, vans on lawns for further comments. Obviously, at this stage, a similar thing would have to be done by some measure of the independent or alternative media. But even in that regard, it hasn't really bloomed out there. I saw some on The Blaze, I think, and InfoWars, a few like that, have reported on the story. But there needs to be more. This is a numbers game, after all, to turn it into the vaccine gate as it actually is. What needs to be done, do you think, at this stage?
Well, just what you're saying. Some reporters down in Atlanta, or reporters that have, bigger personal resources, can go down there, find out where Thompson lives, and go to his house and knock on the door. Make him realize that the pressure is on. You see, there's another vector on this, which now we begin to bring in the so-called autism community here, which involves, well, many people, including, of course, most importantly, parents of autistic children who have seen their children fold up and withdraw from the world after they've been vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
they know the truth in a way that nobody else can.
And they should have the incentive. They should have the energy and the anger to do something right here as well.
Yeah, and they are. They're posting more and more videos online. I just saw another one this morning from a nurse. This is not, as I recall, a parent of an autistic child, but she begins to talk about a member of her family whose child became autistic and the pressure that nurses are under to get vaccinated who work at hospitals and what happens if they refuse and how they can lose their job, et cetera, et cetera. And parents of autistic children are coming out more and more with videos. So that is happening, but the pressure has to be, you know, built up further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there is a strain of opinion in the autism community that this story should more or less be now kept under wraps until a congressional hearing occurs. That's sort of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. You see, Thompson has sent many pages of data, vaccine data, to Congressman Bill Posey of Florida, who is a friendly ear. Thompson has also sent many pages of data to Brian Hooker, and I think to Andrew Wakefield, and maybe other people that I don't know about. Now, Posey's people are going through all this data, thousands of pages. We don't know how many pages.
Mm-hmm.
Does all this information merely relate to the 2004 study, or is it more extensive? We don't know. I can't get a straight answer from Posey's office. So Wakefield has already said on the record that he, that what has to happen is a congressional hearing. Well, we've had those before. They're always exercises in futility as far as getting something done is concerned. People spend many hours and much energy putting them together. People go and testify. We would presume that Thompson would testify himself. I think that would happen. But yet, at the end of the day, the other co-authors on the study would say, well, you know, we understand what he's saying, but our opinion collectively is that we did the right thing and the study is valid as it stands and we did good science. And other CDC people would say the same thing. And then we would have people from the CDC saying, and as far as the whole mercury question is concerned, that's already been settled. We know there is no connection to autism. We've done the studies. We've gone over this meticulously, et cetera, et cetera. And then everybody, you know, would look it around and say, well, wait a minute, this is it? So I've been urging people in print in the autistic community not to put their eggs in that basket, not to say the story can be soft-pedaled until we get a congressional hearing.
No, of course not. Absolutely not. That's the wrong way about it, I believe. It has to be... it's a numbers game, as usual. It has to get out there and get known. And again, I saw some of the comments on, I think it was The Blaze when they posted it. Quite a few comments there, but from a lot of angry parents who are like, if this is true, you know, God help the government kind of thing. You know what I mean? It's like, if they haven't spoken up about this, because I see that they're angry, and I think the momentum could be created to get it out on this level, you know?
Oh, I believe that's true, too. But so far, although, you know, there are major alternative news websites like the one we're talking on right now who have made breakthroughs with this story, but not enough websites.
No, not enough.
Not enough. And there are many science blogs out there, see, that are trying to soft pedal this, as I said, and convince people that it's all a tempest in a teacup and it has nothing to do with reality. And we are the dangerous people.
The wacky conspiracy theorists and, you know, this is pseudoscience. And, yeah, definitely. We've heard
we are
it,
a menace. They're saying that we are a menace because we are turning people off from the idea of vaccination.
Exactly, yeah.
And everybody will get sick and die if they don't get vaccinated, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, was it also just a side note on that? I think I saw like a website set up to like the body count of Jenny McCarthy or something like that, you know, because she's been outspoken
exactly.
About.
And now we have Rob Schneider. Okay. Yeah. Because that's the latest development. He has gone on the record, at about the time that just after the whistleblower Thompson released his public statement. And, Rob, the well-known, comedian and actor from Saturday Night Live and movies, made a very strong statement and published a letter that he sent to California Governor Jerry Brown demanding a response from Brown saying, what are you going to do about this situation where we've now uncovered significant fraud about the dangers of a vaccine and its connection to autism? And of course, he's gotten no answer. This was about, I don't know, a month ago. Now, since then, Rob Schneider has appeared in commercials for State Farm Insurance. But yesterday, or the day before, State Farm became aware through social media protests and so forth that Schneider has a, quote, anti-vaccine stance.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've taken down those TV ads. Hmm. And they've made a public statement, State Farm has. You know, we don't want to get, this has now gotten into peripheral issues and it's deflected attention from the product that we're trying to sell here, you know, and we're going to take the ad down. So this is corporate censorship. And now does Rob Schneider go into the camp of Jenny McCarthy, Suzanne Summers, and other Hollywood personalities who are considered to be, you know, crazy people who are still somewhat entertaining and we can give them a sort of a free pass to continue their careers in showbiz? Or is his career now really going to be marginalized because he's spoken out?
Mm-hmm.
So he's been censored. He's been censored. This just happened yesterday.
Right, yeah.
And, of course, Hollywood personalities are notorious for having to toe the medical line, not just on vaccines, but on everything.
A lot of different things, absolutely.
Oh, I stand for cancer research and give money for this and polio that and yeah. vaccinations. And Leo DiCaprio has now been benighted by the Secretary General of the United Nations as, quote, a messenger of peace. This is the exact title that he now has.
Right, right.
I mean, on climate change, specifically climate change, right?
Yeah.
So I guess the UN is now a church, and they've got a prophet or a saint or whatever it is, right? As if Leo DiCaprio personally knows anything at all about the actual science and pseudoscience behind global warming.
He knows Al Gore. It's all kosher.
I mean, what else do you need to know, right?
Yeah.
He and Al can jet around the world spewing fumes, and they can talk about global warming. So all of these celebrities are pulled into a vortex to front for the establishment, especially on medical matters. The fund to raise money for, you know, MS research. The fund, we need more money for research on social anxiety disorder. You know, we just had a football player, Brandon Marshall, come out and say, you know, his life was saved because of a psychiatrist who diagnosed him with borderline personality disorder. And so he has a foundation now. And, you know, this just keeps on going. It doesn't end. But if somebody from Hollywood were to suddenly come out and say, the world is suffering from massive malnutrition, which leads to many different diseases. And that's what my foundation is all about. Clean up the contaminated water, stop eating the junk food, you know, et cetera, and we will have good health. Because these issues are not basically medical at all. Then that person would receive zero support from foundations and governments and so on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any issue, really, medical issue that's brought to the forefront is always, you know, focused on the vaccine questions. Like, oh, we're looking into a vaccine right now. We'll have it soon, you know. But the question there, of course, is what would happen. Because we've seen character assassinations before. There's been sporadically people here and there, you know, do speaking out about this. But just as you say, that they're kind of, in some weird way, they're kind of still left in the loop to a certain degree, but they're just, ultimately, it comes down to media control, really, and the centralized ownership of the media and the chief editors. And I wonder in what capacity did this occur, in how the conversation goes in the boardrooms and, you know, between there. I guess what we really need as well, John, is some good hackers leaking some stuff from the CDC, turning it into kind of a climate gate issue, because that did take off on a different level, but this hasn't yet, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, when the climate emails from the East Anglia, you know, cohort of so-called researchers was hacked and released, all of a sudden the world could read how these fake scientists were conspiring to slant the published conversation about man-made warming and to exclude people who were not following the party line. So this is exactly the kind of thing that we need now. This has to go deeper and further into the medical complex, which is the most opaque. Because I've done this. Go to WikiLeaks. Go to Cryptome, Public Intelligence. These are websites that publish, you know, untold thousands and thousands of documents that are, you know, either secret or borderline or leaked or whatever on a variety of subjects. And try to find a cache of really good insider medical documents. And you'll be very hard-pressed to find anything at all. anything at all. Mm-hmm. And I've brought this to people's attention in articles that I've written. What's the problem, boys? You know, are these people too completely brainwashed into believing that the medical cartel is infallible? Do they think at these websites that if they were to publish incriminating data about vaccine fraud, that suddenly, you know, say WikiLeaks' reputation would become so stained that nobody would believe anything that they published from that point on? I mean, this is how powerful, you see, the medical cartel and their propaganda machine is, because indeed this could happen to WikiLeaks. If tomorrow suddenly you saw a cache of documents from the CDC that exposed fraud in a variety of studies, and the CDC then came out immediately and poo-pooed the whole thing and denied it and said that WikiLeaks was misinterpreting the data, they had no access to the computer models that the CDC was using, that this was an unsophisticated hack of material that was work product in process, and said, you know, that it doesn't really mean anything. The public and the press would, and the governments of the world would rush to the defense of the media, mainstream, the governments, the CDC, and they would paint WikiLeaks as a bunch of lunatics. This, people have to understand this, and I've been writing about this since 1987, that when you go up against the medical cartel and its propaganda machine, you are going up against the most powerful informational mind control system on the planet, bar none. There are people in high places, aided by dupes in the media and the general public, who will convince billions of people that they are right and that you are not only wrong, but dangerous. That's their system. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're experts at.
Yeah.
You can probe NSA. You can expose the CIA. You know, you can expose the, you know, the Jesuits, the Vatican, you know, the Yakuza, you know, whatever. You can do all of these things, the mafia, but expose the medical cartel in a really deep, significant way with documents, there's no contest in terms of difficulty, degree of difficulty, and what the blowback will be if you're successful, the blowback on you. People have to understand, and that's why, you see, this confession by Thompson is so significant, because now we have an insider who comes out and says, I was there, I did it, I committed fraud, my co-authors did too. This is what happened, you see. We were there.
Yeah.
We did it.
Yeah.
That's why this is so tremendously significant, and that's why it has to be pursued.
Well, and I think you raise a really good point, because it speaks something about all the other things that we see picked up and driven to, you know, add wall-to-wall coverage in the media as well. I mean, you know, as the saying goes, right, to find out who rules over you, simply find out who you're not allowed to criticize, or as in this case, it wouldn't be criticized, but exposed, let's say. But it does say quite a bit of about what is allowed and what is kind of okay in the theatrics of the media environment, because here you have, just as you pointed out earlier, you have all the components are in place, but for some reason, it's, you know, the fish should be on the hook, but it isn't, you know.
But it isn't.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. That is where we are. And for those people who are looking, you know, toward the bigger picture, which I haven't really talked about because I really wanted to lay out all the facts on the table here, the medical cartel itself, and I've been writing about this since 1987, can work covert ops to debilitate, destroy, kill huge numbers of people all over the planet with their toxic medications and vaccines and so forth, because they present themselves as having no political affiliation. no partisan stance. We are neutral. We are scientists. We are humanitarians. We save everybody, you see. And this is what makes it so dangerous. And they can give you fantastic cover stories to explain away what they are doing to people's lives. And their ultimate goal is to enroll the entire population of the planet in a cradle-to-grave system of, quote, medical care through insurance plans and national health care, you know, mandates and so forth. So that they can diagnose and drug and poison and toxify everybody on the planet from cradle to grave with perhaps, let's say, 40 or 50 diagnoses of diseases or disorders from the time that a fetus is in the womb till the time that that person dies. And in the process, make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for the populations of countries to resist their rulers, the powers that be, purely on health reasons, because these populations are so weakened and debilitated and destroyed. You know, so this is, to me, the primary long-term covert op on the planet. This is, of all the cartels, the most dangerous, the deepest, and the most far-reaching. Again, with the most, operates with the most highest degree of impunity, simply because they are so good at presenting themselves as neutral and humanitarian that only a complete lunatic would question their motives. And the overwhelming number of people in their army, the doctors, the medical schools, the hospitals, are indoctrinated to within an inch of their lives through education to become true believers in the cause. So they are not willing participants, for the most part, in the drama and the destruction and the covert op. They just go along because they actually believe, which, you know, to pull that off is quite a feat. This is an object lesson in the nature of widespread conspiracy that shows you exactly how these things can be engineered with so many people involved, where you have critics saying, oh, that's impossible, because if it was all the kind of conspiracy that you say it is, you would have to enroll millions of people in it and word would leak out. Well, no, that's not true.
Yeah.
We can see that. We can see why it's not true. And in this very story that I've been covering in the last hour, we have evidence galore in the fact that there is a media blackout on the story. You know, no, it doesn't have to be revealed. No, it doesn't have to leak out, except we have the internet and we have alternative news sites. But otherwise, no, it doesn't have to become public knowledge at all.
Yeah. Oh, man, yeah, the pharmacopoeia industry certainly has a tremendous spell on people. I mean, you're right, it really is like a religion. They are scientific, you know, in people's mind. They're objective, they're lifesavers. How dare you criticize the Church of Progress, you know? But obviously it's about control and population control, but also a massive money-making machine and to keep people in a perpetual dependency on their way of life. And I think there's numerous different ways that they might be, even if they haven't to this stage, although there are speculations about that, but definitely in the future in terms of vaccines and the development of other types of technologies and nanotechnologies and this kind of material to potentially control people in a completely different way that might or might not be possible today. But also on top of that, this is really what the rest of the world is striving for, to acquire, to get in this position of attaining, you know, this kind of system, really. And as you say, part of that is to nationalize the insurance and the whole health industry, specifically in America, of course. But one point I wanted to bring up again here is you raised the point that William Thompson might be in a position of danger for obvious reason due to what he said, but also for the reason that the story hasn't been breaking into the mass media yet, which I hope it does. that would be something that would be kind of securing him, I believe, a little bit more, because it's one of the scenarios would be, it would be way too obvious if it was out, in the open and very talked about, and if something were to occur and happen. Well, it has happened before, but it would definitely be more suspicious in this regard. But kind of for the sake of helping him out to a certain extent, then I'm back, you know, kind of back in that territory again. Would it be helpful to a certain extent to try to reach him? And I guess this is an encouragement to those people listening who are have the capability of presenting themselves as some kind of alternative media or independent media or just media overall that literally could attempt and try to reach out to this man and try to cover it in a certain degree or get it out to a wider audience in some capacity. If not, what do you see as the kind of the next step in the process here, John?
Well, certainly, yes. If people can try to get to him, they should. The next step is to keep breaking this story wider and wider and wider from all possible vectors so that he does have some protection and cover, as well as to inform the public of what's really going on here. But yes, you're absolutely right. And I did write several stories in which I said, you know, this guy is in grave danger. I don't care what anybody says. Thompson, in his written statement of August 27th, in his confession, tries to poo-poo that. He tries to say, well, everything is fine. I'm still working at the CDC, and he is. And I was never, you know, they never had a problem with them, and they were, you know, we were on very friendly terms and so forth. I don't believe this for a second. There is a danger hanging over this guy's head, a serious danger, a serious threat. And he has a family. And I believe that he is close to retirement, so there's a pension involved as well, which, of course, could be cut off under certain circumstances. There are all manner of threats could be leveled at him, but one of them is death, you know, to be blunt.
Yeah, definitely.
For sure, no question about it. And I agree with you completely that were this story to break much more widely and his name become known all over the world, it would be more difficult if he suddenly died. And that's one reason why the media blackout has to be punctured and penetrated. But on the other hand, and this is from long experience, don't be a person that just keeps hoping and hoping and hoping that CNN or Fox or NBC pick this up.
Mm-hmm. No, of course not.
You don't wait for that because the likelihood is very small. Instead, you keep, and this, you know, applies to anybody, keep spreading the word of these stories. Keep sending links out. Keep informing people you know who have blogs and websites, you know, that this is a major, major story and that they should cover it. Because the wider this goes, as we all know on the net, you get geometric progression and acceleration of coverage that just keeps on going and going and going, and this is what has to happen.
Yeah, it's funny. We actually talked with another guest about that just very recently, that there needs to be kind of a concerted effort to a certain degree. As bad as it is with centralized things, that's not what I'm advocating here, but kind of a recognition from within the more independent-minded media. And they don't have to agree to on all issues and all that. It's not about that. It's just about kind of realizing the importance of certain of these key stories as they come out and try to bring as much focus as possible to it to try to pierce through. We see this in the mainstream media, how they can basically, I mean, it's worldwide releases now, basically. It can completely manipulate the global population due to one story. I mean, it's immensely powerful, and there needs to be some kind of response to this mass media entrainment machine that we're faced with. And these kinds of stories is a perfect trial to begin to develop something that could look like that. I think it's just a recognition of the importance of the situation, and that should lead to kind of an immediate response by as many people as possible. But yeah, let's keep trying. What do you think is going to unfold next here in the process? Is there anything else that could occur, do you think, that could lead to a bigger, some kind of breakthrough, I guess? What do you think?
Well, this is what I've been recommending, and here's where we intersect with the Edward Snowden story. You know, he walks out of the NSA with who knows how many documents, the low end 20,000, the high end 1.7 million, who knows where the actual figure is. And the control of these documents is passed through him into the hands of very few journalists who decide their fate. And that fate, in most, if not all cases, is highly dependent on conferences and meetings with lawyers, representatives of governments, who knows who gets into the act. In the case of Thompson and his thousands of pages of raw data, what is there that could be threatening to anybody? The names of patients in studies? Black them out. That's it. What else?
Right.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Right? So what I've been urging in no uncertain terms, and occasionally getting a little bit nasty about it, is that the people who have these documents now, Ryan Hooker, maybe Wakefield, Congressman Posey, who else, I don't know, dump all the documents online immediately.
Certainly.
Dump them all the pages. The problem is, you see, that, and, you know, people may not like me taking these good people to task, but so be it. Because Brian Hooker's a good man, Andrew Wakefield's a good man, Bill Posey's a good man. In the case of Posey, he's a politician. He's an elected representative. So where does he look for an answer? Congressional hearing. Where does Wakefield look? He's already gone on the record. Congressional hearing. Brian Hooker, it seems to me that where he's looking is to independently published papers by himself, who has access to much of Thompson's data, and maybe a couple of other independent scientists, I don't know who he could give access to, who have a, quote, trained mind and trained eye, who could interpret the data and publish papers. Well, Hooker tried that. He did that. Relative to that specific 2004 pediatric study, he published a paper in a very small journal called Translational Neurodegeneration. And when Thompson went public on August 27th, or shortly after, that journal pulled the paper, retracted or suspended the study of Hooker's that they had already published. So that tells you something about that strategy, right?
Yeah.
And if Hooker is looking at this through the eye of, quote, an independent scientist, that in itself has a certain elitism about it that is self-limiting. I can tell you that just as in the case of Snowden, with the William Thompson documents, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of minds, independent minds, out there in this world, who would love nothing better than to go over all of these Thompson documents and to begin to analyze them and publish their own findings. Some of them will be wrong. Some of them will be right. Some of them will be up in the air because maybe more information is needed, but provisional conclusions can be drawn. A public dialogue can be started among independent thinkers, which has in fact happened on many climate change websites that are independent websites, among people who know that the science behind man-made global warming is a fraud. And they debate and discuss the matter daily on these blogs and websites in very sophisticated technical ways. Thousands of such people. So release all this data, get it out in the public, And then if Hooker wants to, and other people, sure, go back and take a section of that data and say, I'm going to analyze these 16 pages and I'm going to publish something about them because they reveal more fraud. Wonderful. You don't blow the whole force of the story all of a sudden by releasing all the documents. It's not like you can only do this once. You know, to make a comment on the attention span of the public, I could take an article that I've written, let's say in 2012, and I could republish it on my website every 3 weeks. And at least 50% of the people who read it every 3 weeks would think they're reading it for the first time.
Right, yeah.
You know, I mean, is that a condemnation? Take it as you wish. It just happens to be the truth. So for people to think, oh, well, you know, we don't want to blow everything in one, you know, blow our load all at once here. No, we have to dribble out the data to keep the story alive. No, that's completely wrong. That's not the right strategy. You release everything all at once on 15 websites so they can't be shut down before they in turn release it to 5,000 other sites and they to 50,000 and so forth. Now it's all there. Now let the CDC do whatever they want. What are they going to do? File a lawsuit? Love to see it. Love to get in on that deposition. Who owns the information? The CDC? Who is the CDC? It's a branch of the Department of Health and Human Services, which is part of the executive branch, which is ultimately controlled by the president. They're the federal government.
Yeah.
That means they serve the people. So they're suddenly going to assert some kind of exclusivity over the data? No possible way. Too late, never going to happen. Release all the data. Let's start the dialogue. Let's get into this at all levels, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unfortunately, the people who have the data right now, including Thompson, they don't see it that way. But they need to see it that way. That's what we need right now.
Yep, indeed. Now, I want to tie in the Ebola here in a little bit, too, since the CDC is deeply involved in this also, which, of course, consequently should say a lot about their actions in this case and also, of course, their suggestions when it comes to vaccinations and such things. But before we do that, let's see if there's more, on vaccine that we need to get out here first. I had an additional question there as well. As the discussions went in these calls, recorded calls and all that, and potentially in the studies to the papers they talked about, is it here where it was revealed that it was thimerosal, which, of course, has mercury as one of the ingredients in it, that leads to autism, or is there more here? I mean, we know that there are aluminum and other nasty ingredients that act in different ways to kind of kickstart the reactions in the body and things like that. But do you have any more information about that in terms of exactly how this was broken up on the knowledge base front of things?
Yes. Unless something has happened to the MMR vaccine that I don't know about, it contains no mercury. So all of this data about the association and connection between that vaccine and autism has nothing to do with mercury. We could be talking about other toxic chemicals or metals in the vaccine, such as, you know, formaldehyde, polysorbate 80, aluminum. There's a whole list of chemicals in these vaccines. Mm. And then we would also be talking about other germs that get into the vaccines because a vaccine by necessity contains a germ or a piece of a germ that according to the hypothesis is supposed to produce an immune reaction in the recipient. So that if that actual live germ later comes in contact with that person, he's already immune. So that germ or a piece of it or a version of it is in the vaccine intentionally. But as I've written about many times, in the process of manufacture, there is contamination and other germs get into these vaccines. And because the vaccines are injected, they bypass normal channels of immune defense in the body. That's what makes them so dangerous.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's not like you're saying to people, look, we've got a vaccine here, and the way you take it is
breathe it in or something.
You breathe it in, yeah. Or it's, you know, in a tablet, or you rub it on your wrist or something like that, which, you know, yeah, it could be dangerous enough as it is. But this is way worse. This is saying we're getting this in there by sticking you with a needle. So, yes, we're talking about much wider issues here than mercury and vaccines and autism. And then there's something else that the audience needs to know, and I'll try to boil this down. Labels like autism and other such so-called disease or disorder labels, and there are many of them related and connected to autism, you know, developmental delay of this and that. You know, it's like slicing and dicing thinner and thinner. They have all of these different categories of basically what is neurological damage. They give them labels and names and so forth and so on. None of these that are listed as official disorders in the Bible of the psychiatric profession called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, none of these have any physical diagnostic test that defines the disorder. Now, if people think about this, that's a staggering shock. Well, what do you mean there's no test? Then how do they know that a person has autism rather than Asperger's, rather than developmental delay, QX34 of this, or, you know, and the answer is they don't. This is all a cover story. This is all the label game. And I pointed this out in excruciating detail many times in articles. You can go to the DSM and read the entire definition of autism, which is like reading a complex menu of behaviors in a restaurant. You know, this plus that, if this, well, then that, in a period of 3 or 6 months, and, you know, and nowhere will you find under the category of autism any defining test, no blood test, no urine test, no hair sample, no genetic assay, no brain scan, no nothing as the defining test for autism. It doesn't exist. None of the so-called mental disorders, the 300 or so in the DSM, none of them have any physical diagnostic defining test. It's all a shell game. So therefore, what's happening here is the parents of these children are talking really about a very simple thing. Neurological damage, brain damage, impairment as a result of a vaccine. That's the beginning and the end of the story. There is no more to the plot line of that. But the medical people come in and they begin to spin all of this. So that, for example, in the federal vaccine compensation program, where parents of vaccine damaged children can get money from the government because they're not permitted to sue the vaccine manufacturers by law,
mm-hmm.
1986, they go through that nightmare of a labyrinth trying to get compensation. Now they are in the medical territory. And prior to 2002, parents thought that if they could get a doctor to make a diagnosis of autism on their child, that would enable them to get compensated by the government. But what they didn't realize was that the government was firmly committed to never giving any compensation to any parent whose child had a diagnosis of autism, because that would be to admit that there was a link between vaccine damage and so-called autism. In 2002, these parents began to wise up, and they realized that if they could go to a doctor and get a diagnosis of so-called encephalopathy, which is a sort of label for generalized brain disease, they had an outside chance of getting compensation from the government. because the government would then be off the hook. And the government could say, well, yes, sometimes encephalopathy presents itself with symptoms of autism-like features, but we're really giving compensation to the parents for encephalopathy. This is the insanity that parents of brain-damaged children from vaccines have to get into with the government to try to get compensation to care for their children for the rest of their lives. It's all a game of shuffle the labels, do studies, pretend that there are differences between these different, so-called brain disorders, mm-hmm. when none of them yeah. have any diagnostic tests to define them. This is the length to which the CDC and other agencies and research centers and governments will go to obscure the damage that is done by vaccines.
Well, exactly. This makes it seem just incredible that there aren't like a William Thompson every year, every week that speaks out. I mean, they have endless amounts of resources at their disposal and people and personnel and everything else. They're working for them. And I mean, who knows? I guess that would be his insight. He could reveal something of how the procedure goes, how many do actually know, how many people do just trust in the fact that they are in a medical authority and they just don't actually look at the studies for themselves and do the research. It might just be a handful of people. And miraculously, this guy was the one who had an ounce of a conscience here and began to speak out. But you raise a good point. I mean, can you imagine the looming lawsuits in the wings of this thing as well, if that were to get out? We know that they have seemingly endless amounts of money supplies here, but the potential looting of their coffers that we're talking about here, or looting is the wrong word, but the potential money we're talking about here is an issue that stands alone that gives them reason to try everything they can to keep it out of the press. And I mean, we know how much money now the mainstream media channels are getting from the medical establishment too, in advertisements and all this kind of stuff. So it could just be an issue where they basically say, you know, don't touch this because that will cut off your funding. You know, again, who knows of what actually and how this really has been going on here. But it's quite scary, isn't it?
Yeah. You bring up the right point. If the government, CDC, and their allies ever admitted to what we're talking about here, the entire house of the federal government would collapse. There would be no end to the lawsuits, to this, to that, to the recriminations, to the prosecutions, to the prison sentences. It would never end, ever. The entire empire would collapse. That's what is at stake here. That is exactly, because that's the amount of fraud, you know, which is involved here. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
So you mentioned something important. The researchers at the CDC and other centers, you know, vaccine researchers in this case, how much do they actually know? My conclusion after 30 years is the overwhelming number of them intentionally don't want to know anything. Because from what I just said, you know, anybody with a reasonable degree of intelligence pointed in the right direction can discover that none of the 300 so-called mental disorders, including autism and all of its spin-offs and so forth, has any defining diagnostic physical test at all. Talk about a scandal, right?
Yeah.
Well, how many researchers actually know this? Many, many researchers know this. But they rationalize it to themselves, they explain it away, and I've described in detail in articles how they do this, because some of them have gone on the record and exposed themselves with their insane logic, you know, to justify what they're doing. They deny it, they spin it, they explain it, they rationalize it, they pretend it means something what they're saying, you know, all of this kind of thing. They don't want to know, because they have an inkling in their souls that if they recognized and spoke about everything they know, and I include Thompson in this, they would bring the whole house down.
Yeah, including themselves, right? This is a psychological issue,
yeah.
you know. Yeah, the
sure.
denial here. And
first and foremost, yeah. So what does Thompson know? Oh, he knows a great deal. But to get him to admit it, you see, if I could sit down with him, you know, if he said to me, okay, look, I'll let you come into my house for 3 consecutive days. We'll sit here. You can put everything on tape. Take as long as you want. I would eventually bring him around to the point where he would say, it's all a fraud, the whole thing. The whole thing is a fraud. Because now he wants to really limit himself to what he's admitting, as you can see from his published statement. And people can go to Morgan Durkamp, with a K, and find, you know, that's his lawyer, and find that they have the statement is still there on their website. It's one page, August 27th, statement of William Thompson. And see, you know, how he's limiting himself, which is exactly how any whistleblower on the inside would do it. Because if they didn't, you know, if they didn't, they would eventually be talking themselves into exposing the entire fraud from stem to stern. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is a fraud.
Yeah, it's remarkable, really. It is, of how long they've been able to run the ship in this way, and how many people they've fooled in the process. So how do you think we should view the Ebola outbreak in relation to this story? Then I've been very interested in watching the reactions to the story, how it's unfolded, but also, of course, the response, you know, how that has been, and a couple of interesting and very bizarre precaution or, you know, steps have been taken, and people have been even shipped out of the region. I want to address that a little bit more later and whatnot, but it's a big issue here, obviously, and very, very volatile. it could go, you know, quickly really bad, you know, to be honest. But I know that people have questioned even the validity of it, and we get the usual kind of chatter, right, that it's some kind of, you know, medical false flag, etc. I mean, I guess a lot of things are possible. But, give us your take there, John.
Well, it's another long story, Eric. But the thing I learned in 1987, 88, when I was writing my first book, AIDS, Inc., and I was led, you see, I was interviewing many, many people at the time. I knew something was wrong in the way that AIDS and HIV was being presented to the public, but I didn't know what it was. And it was my first book, and at that time, not now, but at that time, a reporter could get access to actual researchers, mainstream researchers, and talk to them directly, which I did at Harvard and the CDC and the National Institutes of Health, talk to them on the phone and get their stories and so forth. And then I had people coming at me when they discovered I was writing that book from everywhere with their own pet theories about AIDS. Some of which, you know, you wouldn't even believe. And so I had notes posted on my walls everywhere. This was, of course, before the internet. And I was in a massive confusion about the whole thing. What is AIDS really? What is HIV really? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually, one of the things of many that I discovered was that in order to understand what the medical cartel was saying about AIDS and its supposed cause, HIV, you had to look at how HIV was being diagnosed, the diagnostic tests that were being used in order to say, you're HIV positive, you're HIV negative, you have AIDS, you don't, you're going to get AIDS, you're not, all of these things. And as maybe silly as that sounds now, that was a major revelation to me. Oh, you mean I have to back up and I have to look at actually how it's being diagnosed? You know, and a few researchers said, well, what do you think? Don't you think that's relevant? You know, and I said, well, now that you mention it, yes. So ever since then, that's been at the forefront of my mind every time one of these so-called epidemics is announced. How are they diagnosing it in the first place? Step back and look at the tests. Because as the story breaks, you see, what we get is, here are the numbers of cases the next day. Here are the numbers of cases. Here's how many people have died from Ebola. Here's, you know, where the new cases are. Here's the old cases. You know, it's all about that. Because what else could it be about? Right? I mean, this is, and who are the people who are telling us this? The CDC, the World Health Organization. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the people who are reporting the statistics.
Yeah.
So before I go any further, let me do a little flashback on the CDC and this very issue. In the summer or the fall of 2009, at the height of the so-called swine flu epidemic, which, if people will recall, was hyped with just about the same amount of force as the current Ebola pandemic, in heavy quotes, Cheryl Atkinson at CBS News broke a story in October of 2009 that a few months earlier, the CDC had stopped counting cases of swine flu in the U.S. What? Stopped counting, right? Now, their only job, you know, was to count cases. That's their job. And to count deaths. But they had stopped. How had they stopped? Well, it turned out that the way the CDC gets their numbers of cases is they go through the state public health agencies in all 50 states of the United States, and they get those reports, and somebody sits down, very sophisticated, with an adding machine and tallies it up and issues a report every week. That's it. Well, in the summer, in July of 2009, the CDC told all the state health departments to stop sending them reports. Why?
Yeah.
Well, what the CDC said was, and this was a point at which they said there were tens of thousands of cases in the U.S. of swine flu. They said, well, we know it's an epidemic and that's all we need to know. So who cares? But as Cheryl Atkinson and one other researcher, Peter Doshi, who's now a PhD researcher, professor at, I believe, the University of Maryland, exposed, there was a real reason behind why the CDC stopped counting cases. Because likely cases, highly likely cases, all over the country of swine flu had their blood samples taken and sent to labs for analysis. Because, according to the researchers, they knew the cause of swine flu, which was the H1N1 virus. And so we send many, many of these samples out for diagnosis, testing. The overwhelming number of these blood samples came back negative for swine flu and also negative for any other kind of flu, including regular seasonal flu. And yet, these were the most likely cases and the diagnosed, you know, cases who would walk into clinics and with the symptoms and so forth in hospitals. And right away, people would say, swine flu, doctor, you know, let's take a blood sample. Well, it turned out that was totally false. Wow. CDC is now scrambling. Well, what are we going to do about this? I mean, we're in danger of exposing ourselves that this whole thing is out of control. It's lunacy. It's a fraud. Everything we're saying is being counteracted by our own lab tests. So what can we do? Well, the only thing we can do is to say that we stop counting cases and we don't care about lab tests anymore because we already know it's an epidemic. Well, they didn't already know, as their lab tests were proving. All this was exposed by one single story at CBS News online by Cheryl Atkinson in October of 2009, and subsequently by an analysis by Peter Doshi published in, I believe it was BMJ, British Medical Journal, online. So, here's what happens next. The CDC is in a dither. You know, they've tried to cover it all up. 2 weeks after, roughly 2 weeks after Cheryl Atkins' story appears, as recounted in the WebMD story, which I've quoted, the CDC goes public and says their best estimate of the number of swine flu cases in the U.S. at a time when they had previously said tens of thousands, 22 million. 22 million.
Right.
Roughly one out of 14 people in the U.S. have swine flu. I mean, this is like, you know, if they won't believe this lie, tell the biggest lie you can because they're going to buy that one.
Right.
Because it's so staggering, right? I mean, you know, when I read that, I fell off the chair. So now, parallel situation, a day or two ago, the CDC comes out and says, if this is not stopped, Ebola, by late January, we will have 1 million cases of Ebola.
Yep, that's right.
On the heels of whatever you want to say, 5,000, 10,000 cases, and maybe 2,000 or 3,000 deaths, or whatever, you know, the numbers are up for grabs. But now that the CDC decides, let's say 1 million, okay? Let's up the ante here. Because what is the CDC all about, really, when you break it down? They're a PR agency for the vaccine industry and for medical drugs treatment. So that's what they do. That's not their assigned job, but that's their real job. So if an Ebola vaccine is released for the public, along with various drugs that would be said to be antivirals and possibly effective and blah, 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 then the vaccine makers, who are represented really by the CDC, would be selling billions of dollars worth of Ebola vaccine. So that's kind of, you know, the first shot out of the box for people to understand what's happening with Ebola. And the second shot out of the box is, how are these cases of Ebola being diagnosed? What are the tests that these agencies claim prove that these people really have the Ebola virus, and that's why they're sick, and that's why they're dying? And of course, like I say, every time one of these shows up, that's where I go right away, because I learned my lesson in 1988.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and that's all you can do, because otherwise you just are victims of the propaganda. You see this little picture of a worm that, oh, this is the Ebola virus. And the initial shot of propaganda was everybody who's got Ebola is suddenly sneezing and vomiting blood all over everybody else. Oh my God, and with these pictures in mind, the whole thing is being promoted. And of course, it turns out later that they say, well, you know, actually 5%, maybe 10% of the people who die actually have a lot of hemorrhaging, and, you know, they begin to hedge their bets and back off and all of this. But the initial, you know, fright, terror, terrorist campaign of the invisible virus killing everybody on the planet is these images.
Yep.
So if you don't want to be victimized by that, you have to go to the diagnostic tests. And so the two foremost tests, as usual, turn out to be so-called antibody test and the PCR test. Well, the antibody test is as follows. You take a blood sample from a patient and you decide through various means in a lab whether they have antibodies to that specific virus called Ebola. What does that mean? That means, supposedly, that the patient's immune system has been called to defend the body against the incursion or the presence of that particular virus, Ebola, because the antibodies are messengers of the immune system that go out and try to hunt down invaders, and there are different sets of antibodies that are specific to different specific viruses. And so if the patient has antibodies that show up on this blood test that are specific to the Ebola virus, you say, aha, we have an Ebola case here. Well, that's not the way traditional conventional medicine even was done prior to 1985. In fact, prior to 1985, an antibody test was generally looked upon as a good thing for the patient. Okay, your immune system has swung into gear. That most likely means that you've either warded off the germ that we're talking about already, or that you will be able to ward it off in the future. And at best, all we would be able to say is that your body contacted the germ. Doesn't mean you're going to get sick, or you are sick, or you will get sick. But in 1985, because of HIV research, and I won't go into that long story, the traditional medical outlook was intentionally turned on its head to mean that if a person came up positive with HIV, that meant that they were in danger and they probably would die at some point. And so ever since then, antibody tests have been interpreted the reverse of the way they had been interpreted before, for anything. And in the case of Ebola, the same is true. So the antibody test means nothing. Furthermore, these antibody tests are notorious for registering positive because of what's called a cross reaction. In other words, they're not really responding to the presence of the Ebola virus, although they're supposed to, but they're responding to other things in the body that could range over a wide area, like the person got a vaccine for something else at some point. The person has been drinking alcohol. The person has been eating junk food. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Yep.
That's called a cross reaction, which in that case, the test means nothing as well. The PCR test, which is the polymerase chain reaction, is a highly sophisticated test that was developed by Kerry Mullis of California, who won a Nobel Prize for it. But that test is really for something else. You take a tiny bit of cellular debris from a patient, which is so small that you can't even see it, to analyze it. You assume and hope and think that it's a piece of a virus, and you can now amplify it and blow it up enormously many, many, many times so that you can observe it and say, hopefully, what it is. All of that is highly problematic when you're looking at viruses, whether or not you can succeed in that. Yes, you can amplify the samples tremendously, but is it really part of a virus in the first place, and what are you looking at now? So that test is not specific enough to let you know that, aha, this patient's blood sample shows us, or tissue sample shows us Ebola, nor certainly does it show you that there is enough Ebola operating in the patient to actually cause that patient disease, because you needed the PCR in the first place because you could detect so little of that in the person's body to begin with that you had to blow it up thousands and maybe millions of times to even see it. So that's a non-starter of a test too. So if these two tests are being used to diagnose Ebola, we're sunk. I mean, we're really sunk. We don't know why these people are dying, nor do we know to what degree in West Africa, Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, they're suddenly dying. We're told that all of a sudden this is happening, but is that really true?
Yeah.
Because you certainly can't say these people are, quote, previously healthy, and now suddenly they're dropping like flies. I've written extensively about this. People are living there in a bed that breeds disease. Malnutrition, severe generation starvation, sewage mixed in with the water, overcrowding, lack of basic sanitation, toxic vaccination campaigns that have already been carried out in that area for yellow fever, polio, meningitis, industrial pollutants from rubber factory, soda factory in the soil and the water, a decade or more of horrendous war causing homelessness, displaced people wandering around. When people are thought to have Ebola, suddenly they're kicked out of the home and they become pariahs walking around with no support system whatsoever, and they die. This is the basic condition of these societies. And now you're going to say that it's all Ebola. Complete
right.
lie.
Yeah.
And not only that, Ebola now becomes, as HIV did in Africa, a magnificent cover story. Oh, well, you know, we can't really fix any of these conditions, you know, that exist all the time in our countries to promote health. And we don't want to tell you what they are. We want to keep that out of the newspapers because we want to keep these populations weak and debilitated and dying and dead because we have countries, these are the local dictators and the governments and the power players in these countries, because our countries happen to be incredibly important for minerals, for gold, for diamonds, for all kinds of stuff here. In fact, in Sierra Leone, we've got diamonds lying on the beach called alluvial diamonds, and we have to protect these from people stealing them and running off with them. And we've got, you know, the UN is helping us there. In fact, this is what we call blood diamonds or conflict diamonds. That's what these diamonds are. They're the diamonds lying on the beach. So we tell a cover story about how these diamonds are always being used to finance revolution and death and dying and war in order to convince the world not to sell these diamonds. And but really what we're trying to do, you know, the De Beers syndicate and the people that took them over, is to protect these diamonds from getting out into the market, because then the price of diamonds would drop and we're controlling the prices. And giant corporations and financiers and investors want to get into these countries and decimate them even further and kill as many people off as possible in order to get control of the resources and move in and, you know, make billions of profits and trillions and who knows how much. So we need a cover story all the time for that. We have the actual ways to kill the people, which are ongoing, which I just mentioned, and we're not going to change any of those conditions, because if we did, if we began to make sure that people got fed and they got the stolen farmland back and we cleaned up the water supplies, which any company, you know, could do in a matter of months, and all of these things, and stop the overcrowding, and then people would begin to get healthy, they'd begin to get strong, they'd be able to think, they'd be able to look around and see what's happening, and who has the power, and who's trying to take it away from them, and then we could have real trouble, so we don't want that. So let's say that everything bad that's happening in these countries is called Ebola. When in fact, when you have a bed in which disease propagates every single day of every single year for decades because of the basic terrain and the conditions that destroy people's immune systems, which is really what we're talking about here. That's what we're really talking about. Then any germ that sweeps through, Ebola, cholera, polio, anything, is going to kill thousands and who knows, excuse me, how many people, because they have no immune systems left. So we could test for Ebola, we could test for cholera, we could test for polio, we could test for 100 different germs in these people in these countries that are dying right now, and we would find those germs because they thrive when people's immune systems are destroyed through these different methods. And if we were to take the Ebola virus and somehow plant it in Beverly Hills or Scarsdale, or the most opulent, affluent suburb of an Australian city or a city in the Netherlands, nothing like this would happen. Nothing like this would happen. So now we're looking at something way, way different. Way, way different. And the ultimate payoff for the medical machine, the drugs, the vaccine, the conditioning, further conditioning of the populace to having to accept vaccination.
Yeah.
Because if they release a vaccine in America, they're going to say, and anywhere, you know, Netherlands, Germany, England, Australia, Africa, they're going to say The people we say have to have it, have to have it. There is no resistance allowed. If you don't take it, we will quarantine you and isolate you. We don't care if you're healthy, sick, whatever.
Yeah, you can't choose if you want this or not. This is, yeah, exactly. It's a liability for everybody. Consequently, this is what's happening to you, you know? Because what I found really interesting, I want to sneak that in here as well, is that I realized that they were, as these stories were breaking and everything else, they detailed how basically there were the people were allowed to fly out, certain people, there was some, and one diplomat to fly to Minnesota, one was flown to Nebraska, of course, four patients, I think, to Georgia. You had recently one man who they claimed was bitten. I don't know how that happened, but I guess that's now we're in the zombie apocalypse territory of the CDC here. But he was bitten, and he was flown to Switzerland. Another patient was flown to Germany and additionally to Spain. So it's like, all right, I think I see what they're doing here. You know, it's like if it's tangible, they're exporting it. If it's not, then of course it's about the promotion of the vaccine that is the real core issue in terms of at least the West and Europe and America. And then in the other case is what you had, which is of course of keeping the debilitating aspects in play in, of course, these countries where it's broken out, and of course they can have their presence there. And I think, what was it, the IMF readied, I forget the exact number now, but the X amount of
128 million.
There you go, exactly. So, you know, number of these things are happening at the same time here, you know.
The IMF, of course, makes deals with these countries. They say, we'll give you the money, but here's what you have to do. And, of course, what that means is more outside investment money taking over more of the rich minerals and the industries and the mining and, you know, whatever is the farmland, whatever's there to take over. You have to let in these people, more of these people that are coming into your country. And they can invest their money. They can pull it out at any time, leaving you in the lurch. You know, these are the kinds of deals that are made. And, of course, they're sealing off the borders now. So anything could be happening. These countries, they could have released a toxic chemical in these countries to begin with, and said it was Ebola, or they do it now, or they did it then and they do it now. Yeah, let's kill another 20,000 people here, because we know with the chemical, we understand what's going to happen, and we know when the chemical dissipates, and all we have to do is stay away until it's gone. You know, there's all kinds of things that you can do behind the cover story of the germ. That's what's so workable for this kind of an operation where the medical cartel, is really in charge of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the basic operation. Now, in addition to that, we have these health workers, okay? Early on, I began researching, okay, so they're saying that, we've got some health workers that are dropping like flies in Ebola. What's that all about? Okay, so a story appears in the press and Daily Mail. Oh, so here's what the doctors are doing in these little, makeshift clinics. Very high temperature there. And they're put in these hazmat suits, sealing them off from the outside completely. And the temperature in these suits is boiling. And the doctors are saying that within an hour, they lose 5 liters of body fluids. You try that sometime and see how you feel. Then they come out after an hour, 1 hour, 5 liters. Now they're disinfected with toxic chemicals. And now they're rehydrated. How do you do that? Well, the only way you can do that is through IV. Okay. That's not just a little walk in the park. Then they go back in for another shift. They lose 5 more liters. In fact, one of the doctors said, we're stepping it up now. We're not doing 1 hour shifts. We're doing 2 hour shifts. So how many liters of body fluids do you lose then? 10? I don't know. I don't even know if you can and still live. So then one doctor, comments, not only was I inside the boiling suit and losing all the bodily fluids, but there was an intense smell of chlorine inside the suit. Well, what does that mean? He's sealed off from the outside. What that means is he's in there with chlorine is in there too with him. Highly toxic chemical. at the same time. So it's no wonder that these health workers, some of them, are coming out dropping like flies. And, of course, that's being called Ebola. Eyeball diagnosis. In all of this, people have to understand. I don't care whether it's Ebola, swine flu, bird flu, SARS, whatever, West Nile. When the public health agencies like the CDC and the World Health Organization say it's time to start piling up the case numbers, what that means is that in clinics, hospitals, doctors' offices, everywhere where patients walk in with the generalized symptoms of fever, cough, headache, fatigue, etc., you know, diarrhea, whatever. Most of all, it's an eyeball diagnosis. That's what really is happening on the ground. Oh, he's got swine flu. Oh, it's SARS. Oh, it's this. Oh, it's Ebola. That's the way it really works in most cases, most of the time, anywhere in the world. And in these cases, with the health workers, the doctors, it certainly worked that way in West Africa. So they fly a guy back to Atlanta. They rehydrate him. Now maybe they give him an experimental drug, and fortunately it doesn't kill him. And maybe they pump him full of minerals and vitamins, and they feed him some food, and he sleeps, and he relaxes, and he's in a safe environment, and it's clean, and the sanitation is good. And lo and behold, he walks out of there restored. In fact, according to photos that I've seen, they didn't even bother to take this guy Brantley and put him in a chamber when they wheeled him out of they took him out of the ambulance and wheeled him into the hospital or the clinic in Atlanta when they brought him back.
Yeah.
You know, so what does that say about what they considered the danger was?
Well, that's just it. And I think that could be, you know, potentially, well, again, we can view many different ways this, but it's that idea that for those people who have a brain and can figure this out, but might still kind of take the word of the CDC for what they say, then they would say, wait a minute, my God, what are they doing here? Is this an inconsistency in how they should be treated? In other words, they could even start spreading the lie that, oh, my God, now it's spread. It wasn't contained properly. It seems like this person was, you know, given it, what have you. And you'd have a run to the medical establishments for people that wanted to take this vaccine, of course, to be protected against it, which is that secondary motive here, I think, you know?
Sure. How about this as a story? 6 cases reported in Atlanta, Ebola. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Under close questioning, hospital personnel admitted that when Brantley arrived back in the United States, they were caught off guard and did not have a sealed compartment that they could put him in to take him into the hospital, and they were now faced with a life or death situation. Either we leave him in the ambulance for a matter of hours, who knows how long, until we can get one of those compartments here. He might die. Or we just take him into the hospital on a stretcher, and we made the judgment call. And it's quite possible, yes, we confess, that at that point there could have been a contagion factor that could account for these 6 new cases of Ebola in Atlanta. Hysteria goes crazy, right? That's
exactly
the kind of cover story that, you know, you could see develop out of this. So these are the strategies, these are the techniques, this is the propaganda, this is the way it actually operates. But the problem is that in order for people to understand this and see it, they have to go back to the beginning of what makes disease, what makes a disorder, how are they diagnosed, what does the fact that a person, quote, has a germ actually mean? And if they don't do that, they'll never catch up to the propaganda. That's why, as part of my work, I try to educate people into these basic factors so that they can catch up. Because, for example, as I briefly mentioned, let's say that a person has a certain germ. For example, in the case of SARS back in 2003, if people remember that big scare that turned out to be a dud, right?
Yep.
A massive dud. They said, oh, it's a coronavirus. So if a person is said to have the virus, that virus in the body, 99% of the public would then believe that that person is, quote, infected and will become ill. Well, that's not the case at all. Because in order for a person who has that virus to become, or even to begin to say that he might become ill, you would have to demonstrate that he has a whole bunch of these coronaviruses chomping away in cells of his body, millions and millions of them, not just one or two. That's a further consideration that nobody talks about, but there is a medical term for that called titer, which in America is spelled T-I-T-E-R, and in England would be T-I-T-R-E, and it means the density or the concentration or the numbers of virus, of a specific virus present in the body. That's the loose definition. And in order to begin to even think that a person is going to become ill who has a certain virus in the body, you would have to demonstrate that the titer is high, that there is a great concentration of that in that patient's body. Well, during the swine flu epidemic in 2009, which also turned out to be a dud, I corresponded with a specialist researcher, MD, in England, and asked him the blunt question, is a titer test being done on blood samples of people who are diagnosed with swine flu, to your knowledge? And he got back to me and he said, I don't know. Really, he said the test is very expensive and it's complex, implying therefore that it wasn't really being done. So there you go. And in 2003, again, SARS, a microbiologist named Frank Plummer, who worked for the World Health Organization in Canada, began to make, because apparently he was very naive, public statements to the press, updates on SARS. And he was progressively reporting the numbers of people diagnosed with SARS who actually they could detect the coronavirus, the cause, in their bodies. And he began to say 60%, 40%, 30%, and then he finally said just about 0%. Well, What does that mean? That means you're saying, okay, there is this thing called SARS. It's a disease, very dangerous. The cause of it is, quote, the coronavirus. So, you know, that's the only way that you get the disease through the cause. And yet, we're finding it now in SARS patients 0% of the time.
Yeah.
You see, these are the stories that don't make an impression on the public because the public doesn't understand the background and isn't educated enough to go back to the beginning of the story about disease, which really is the story of the immune system. And reading up on the history of disease in the West and so-called infectious disease in the West, the good history, what you really realize is, and for those who want to read a very good book that goes into this in several chapters, Medical Nemesis by Ivan Illich, 1976, out of print now, but I'm sure you can find it. The real reason that so-called infectious disease began to decline sharply in the West was because society began to change. It had nothing to do with medicine or the medical apparatus. It had to do with, first and foremost, better nutrition, the rise of the middle class, better sanitation, because, you know, you could see pictures of city neighborhoods where sewage was running in the streets, right? Cleaning that up.
Yeah.
More trade, more commerce, more, you know, energetic societies being propelled by trade and merchants and, you know, the rise of elements of modern life that overcame environmental conditions like what I had been describing in West Africa, which pertained in the West all over, that were being changed. That's why, because when you better those conditions, people's immune systems begin to become much more robust. That's what happens. And now you can see that Western societies are crumbling and decaying back into the former conditions.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
And it's now it's like it's overkill on the things we have at our disposal as we move away from the natural materials, as we begin to decline in the nutrition again in the food and GMOs and all this garbage we're eating and wearing and sitting on and sleeping on, all this, all that stuff is leading to this. But just to mention something there quick, of course, we're told also, this is part of the medical, the establishment here, that it's, you know, no, it's due to the vaccinations that we that we managed to survive, right? It's, I mean, Jonas Salk, you know, the saviors of society, you know, the different vaccines that managed to get us to this place. So they've kind of, you know, programmed us to believe that this is the very reason why we survived, not of these other things that you said. And I think that's why we're kind of psychologically in that position of kind of servitude and gratitude towards, you know, the pharmaceutical establishment, you know?
You bet. One of the things that I did in 1987, 88, when I was researching my first book, AIDS, Inc., was I began to read about vaccines, and I went back through some of the very early history of vaccination, smallpox vaccination in England, because the conventional history had it that this was such an overwhelming success that, you know, Edward Jenner and so forth gave birth to this miracle of modern medicine. But I discovered that there was an alternative and suppressed history of that vaccination in England, written in books of the time, that revealed, for example, that in certain cities where there was great deal of vaccination against smallpox, there were huge outbreaks of smallpox. And in certain places where there had been almost no vaccination, there was a very low rate of smallpox. Just the opposite of what the conventional history had told us, the story, the propaganda, the narrative that had been floated to explain this miracle that we should all, as you say, become subservient to. And Ivan Illich, in his book, Medical Nemesis, makes that point very clear, that the drastic decline of infectious diseases, so-called infectious diseases in the West, was occurring long before the onset of, you know, immunization and antibiotics. It wasn't a medical solution at all. But the medical empire has adopted that narrative as its own, as happens so often.
Yeah.
Who is the savior? Well, we are the savior. That's the story that we want to tell.
Yeah.
And we do.
So, just to kind of reemphasize this point here, what you're saying here is that we're looking at a completely fabricated event that is ramped up largely by the media, the press, and you know, again, it goes viral and people repost, and they, you know, that it's kind of just, it's what happens, right? But and then of course people have other what should we call them, referrals, things of they go to things that they've seen in other in other types of ways, like Contagion and an Outbreak in other of these Hollywood movies of what could happen or how it's supposed to be or whatever. So again, to clarify, in other words, you wouldn't worry too much about this spreading in the way that they say it's going to. And ultimately, this is a number of different reasons that you explained, but, you know, vaccines in the West, continued kind of resource grab in the regions where this is breaking out. That's kind of your bottom line analysis of the situation, if I have that correct.
You do. Also put in there drugs as well, because what we could see is we don't have a vaccine. And again, we don't have a vaccine. Oh, we tried this vaccine. Okay, we're having limited, and they've also done this, right? Limited release experimental of a vaccine, or, you know, didn't work out too well. Or apparently, I haven't really vetted this story yet, of today, in a very small group. It only worked in white people, and it didn't work in black people.
I know. Exactly. We actually posted that story. And it's very interesting for a number of reasons. And the more I looked into it, it seems that this is another spoof, actually. But again, it was interesting about it nonetheless, and that's what I kind of brought attention to. And it was just this aspect of how the disease was exported, to Europe and to America for that potential reason of trying to push that way, the vaccine on white people, because they said, like, all right, you go ahead and take this, and you other guys don't need to bother with it. But there is some vetting to be done on that story. Let me just say that. So
yeah, I think so. But here's what could happen. Some company will say, and the government will say, okay, so we don't have a vaccine, but we have antiviral drugs. They do carry risk, but under the circumstances, because this is so lethal, this is what we recommend. And so that would become the profit bonanza instead of the vaccine. You know, two or three antiviral drugs, which all turn out, as a matter of fact, to have very toxic adverse effects, which if they, knock down people, that would be said to be, well, that was Ebola.
Well, exactly. You could get the cure and now you have the disease, right?
Yeah, well, he had Ebola, or he was in danger of having Ebola, so we gave him the drug. 3 days later, he collapsed, and 4 days later, he was in a coma. We don't think he's going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question, well, what happened? Well, it was the rapid onset of Ebola that caused this. Oh, not the drug. No. Yeah, there are certain adverse effects of the drug, but they never would have caused anything like this. It was Ebola. This is the theme over and over and over again. See, didn't die of the disease. Didn't die of the drug, died of the disease. It just happened more quickly than we thought it did. I could cite numerous examples of this. So you could look for, where are the dollars coming from in the giant bonanza? Well, they could be coming from drugs instead of a vaccine. Or they could suddenly rush a vaccine into production and then demand that, everybody take it. Or instead of saying all Americans, they could say something like, everybody in Minnesota and Georgia, they could start off that way.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. And then they would also, of course, do that in Europe. Or they could, this isn't just an or, it could be an and or. Isolation, quarantine. We can't take a chance. We're going to do quarantine. In the city of, pick a city, Minneapolis or whatever. Businesses will close for 4 days. We want people in this sector of the city to stay home. If this does not work out well, we'll bring in the National Guard to enforce it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then the World Health Organization, as they did in 2003 with SARS, will issue an advisory. Plane flights in and out of Minneapolis canceled until further notice, or you're advised, except in extreme cases, not to fly in or out. Not allowed to fly out, and unless you have extremely important business, not to fly in. We could see something like that. And that we could see in a number of countries, not just the U.S. We could see it in Germany. We could see it in Holland. We could see it in England. We could see it in different parts of Africa. We could see it, we got six cases in South Africa. Okay, we have to shut down half of, Joburg or someplace else, Durban, whatever. You could see that. In which case, again, this is more conditioning to accept these kinds of covert ops and their consequences. Oh, yeah, okay, well, when the government says we do this, we do it. They say they shut down a section of Boston when they were hunting for the marathon killers. So, this is even worse.
Definitely.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
So, okay, we'll stay indoors, and if police come knocking on the door, we'll talk to them and tell them everything we can, and, Sure, absolutely. I mean, we want to aid the authorities. They're looking out for us. We're dependent on everything that they do, and we support them. That's the other half of this.
Yeah.
Public support overwhelmingly in favor of this. And then any citizens or people in the area that resist or protest, they're singled out as the, you know, potential menaces and crazy people that get, you know, a minute on the evening news. Okay, he was led into his house, and he was told gently that he couldn't leave because he refused to be isolated like everybody else and refused to follow directions. Oh, everybody goes, yeah, we have to follow directions. I mean, of course, otherwise everything breaks down. I mean, this is where all of this goes. This is where national health insurance plans go. This is where your checkups and your boosters for vaccines. You can go to the CDC website as a parent and print out a schedule with dates for the whatever it is, 30, 40, 50 shots of vaccines that your child has to get. Oh, parent-friendly, print out the schedule with the dates and post it up on the icebox, you know. And because we know you want to obey, and we're here to help you obey. You bet. This is the compliant society. We support the police. We support the troops. We support the doctors. We support the government, the CDC, the NIH,
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, if this goes far enough, you could have the entire civilization could be moved underground just due to the obedience level here alone. You know, it's absurd to think about it. But the big question here is, of course, that people need to ask is, you know, consideration, what we've talked about here with the vaccine issue, autism, these kinds of links, the way that's being kept out of public knowledge and covered up, etc. Do people really trust the CDC? And if they do, they should seriously reevaluate that. And furthermore, do they trust the government and what Big Pharma ultimately at the end of the rope as well is telling people? And I mean, that's the greatest advice in this whole program, I think, to get people really to question that aspect and not just kind of fall for what they're creating. I mean, it's a classic one, of course. It's one of those no events that they're playing up. And then, of course, if there is something real and tangible that is going on, downplay that and don't even focus on it. It's a complete bait and switch, you know, whatever you call that. It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
It is pretty amazing. Another thing about vaccines, of course, two things really. One is, without anything exotic or sophisticated beyond what already exists, vaccines contain toxic elements. Okay? You don't have to go to extremes of speculation about a particular vaccine to understand that. So, and as evidence, the parents of autistic children, you don't have to assume that the MMR or the DTaP or the flu vaccine or any of these has something secret beyond what's already in them in order to cause grave damage. And point number two is, however, because you have such acceptance in the population of vaccines, you do in fact have a route of transmission directly into the body. So that if someone wants to add something that isn't already there, that will create bizarre and horrendous effects, they've got it. They don't have to come up with another method. It already exists. I'm not saying there is no other method, because, of course, we know there are many methods. You know, I mean, we could talk about GMOs and pesticides and, you know, weather engineering and all that sort of stuff. But
yeah,
right here with vaccines, they've got a route through a needle directly into the blood, into the body. Whereas if they do want to add something that's not already there, whether it's in the form of a germ or chemical. They certainly can do it. And everything I said about the immune system being the major regulator of health and disease can go out the window when you are injecting something into the body, because now this is completely unnatural and you are bypassing the normal channels of immune defense that the body has. So all bets are off at that point. And so that's the way, you know, a perspective on vaccines, how to see that,
yeah,
how to know that that's what we're looking at here.
Yep, it's very, very important, you know, and the continuing questioning of what is done to people and what is put in them and everything else. And these are live experiments in some cases, as we know, if we look at, you know, biological, you know, warfare history and development, and the willingness to just kind of experiment on people has been tremendously revealing in terms of how they view us overall, you know, the elite and what they do here. But well, it certainly is no, you know, end to things that we could talk about in consideration to, you know, how this fits into the bigger picture and everything else, John. But what do you think here in terms of any additional thoughts either on the autism story and vaccines and or the Ebola story, and then we can begin to round things up here in a little bit here. But yeah, what do you think? Any closing thoughts here?
Well, as far as the vaccine autism story, believe the mothers. All of the scientific, which is really the pseudoscientific rigmarole and the studies and the this and the that and the, you know,
yeah,
that obscures the issue. If you believe the mothers, they know. They know who their child was before the vaccine and after the vaccine. They understand that. And because they do, they are the primary witnesses to what has been happening. The smokescreen is, oh, do we call this autism? Do we call this this? Do we call it that? Do we call it this? Do we call it that? None of that really matters. It's damage. That's what you call it because that's what it is. It's neurological damage, brain damage. And all of the posturing and positioning of the medical establishment to try to deny any connection between vaccines and what they are calling autism or something else or Asperger's and so forth, all of that is nothing more than an attempt to get off the hook, to break the connection. The story has a simplicity and a horrible tragedy to it, which is told by the mothers. They know. They were there. Believe them. If that's where you begin, then you understand what we're really talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's how I would wind this up.
Well, very good. I mean, thank you for keeping an eye on these stories, you know, for us, and of course doing what all journalists should do and investigate this properly and looking into it and the background and as always putting it into context. It's very important to connect the dots, you know, and realize there's prior precedence to what is happening now if we just look at the historical record and how this has been performed, you know, before. And it's where people who don't do that, they realize that they're being fooled, you know, again and again and again over again. But great work on following this story, John. Please, you know, keep up the good work. But I want to tell people about your Matrix series. Also, I know that you do have a couple of books out. You mentioned AIDS Inc. and all that stuff. You have a one on Oklahoma City bombings, the ownership of all life, etc. I don't think we've mentioned too many of the books before. Are they all available and still in print through your website? Where can people go to find the copies of these books?
Well, the books are, and many seminars that I've given, audio seminars and new work, both text and audio, are now all encased after a great deal of effort in these three Matrix collections, The Matrix Revealed, Exit from the Matrix, and Power Outside the Matrix. And they are collections that people can read about on my website, nomorefakenews.com. And I decided to put all of this into that form so that people would be able to get the full force of what is being presented rather than in a piecemeal way. I felt there was a certain lack of coherence that I wanted to remedy, and that started 4 or 5 years ago, I guess now. And so I began to assemble all this information from 30 years of work and realized, you know, how much it was in terms of quantity. And then I knew that I also wanted to do a lot of new work, which I did. And so that's where all of this is available now, and people can read about that at No More Fake News.
All right, great. NoMoreFakeNews.com. Check out the Matrix series, and, of course, a lot of the material here that we've talked about is kind of condensed in that as well. And also follow John's writings here on the stories as they kind of continue to evolve, both the Ebola story but also the vaccine autism link. And we'll see what happens there, John, and maybe we can continue and in the future discuss updates on this, because hopefully, and of course with the aid of both people listening but also, you know, other journalists out there, and people continue to push on this and, of course, do what they can do to get out the story and spread it to as many people as possible, hopefully this is something that we'll discuss much more in the future, and as this kind of breaks into the mainstream. So keep up the good work, John. Thank you again for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for providing this great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope you can join in on helping to spread the word about the vaccine fraud, as it's a huge piece in the puzzle to help crumble the credibility of those who are supposed to represent the people and claim that they have our best interest at heart. Many different things hinges on these kinds of issues. Of course, even internationally, this would cause massive waves as well. We'll keep watching the Ebola story too, with this new information in mind. I've been wary of always running with the conclusion that everything you see is fake, as it's a very easy way out for conspiracy folks to do so, a kind of a one-size-fits-all approach. You know, they always make the determination, okay, it's fake, now we just need to find the proof that it's fake. In some cases, not even that. But John raises some very good points in this program, and as always, as with all events, I repeat, all events, we should demand proof for the claims, especially when we are asked to change our way of life or fork out money or whatever it might be. Keep that in mind. Well, thank you for listening today, and my thanks to the team as well. Stay tuned to RedIceQuestions.com for more, and also check out RedIceMembers.com for our full archives with all previous programs in full right there. Kevin McDonald, Dennis Fetcho, Veronica Clark, John DeNugent, and Susan Lindauer are some of our upcoming guests. Well, I hope you have a good weekend. Stay healthy, stay sane, and keep your chin up. You know, questioning everything and re-evaluating everything we've been told is a unique and a beautiful ability that I think you should be proud of. Okay, we'll talk more in just a few days. Take care. Thank you.